picking up a loose end from last time a little bit. And I want to make this kind of clear. You know, Hunter makes a very good point. He argues, he says, we have to recognize there is plenty of evidence for evolution. I mean, there is, in a sense. If your presupposition is that there is no God who would do it like this, and look at all this stuff, and it all fits our story that it happened through, you know, gradual change between the species and, you know, climbing up from less complex to more complex. And look, we have similar DNA. We have, you know, homologies, you know, the pendactyl patterns. We have this and that. And we have common ancestry. We can trace it. You know, all that makes incredible sense and is compelling evidence if that's your assumption going in. But Hunter's point is also well taken that if your presupposition is, no, there's a God who created this, and there is, in fact, no evidence that shows a jump from one species to the next, and, in fact, there's a lot of reason to say that it's absurd, then none of it makes sense. But, you see, it all depends on your presupposition. And this is one of the reasons this kind of gets back to Nate's question again. This is just one little piece. But this is kind of the point I want to make, that when people start saying, we've got to reconcile these two, well, they're not as odds as much as you might think they are. What's really at odds is the understanding underneath it, the presuppositions going in. That's what's at odds. And the only reason that there is, and here's the big point, the only reason there's lots of evidence for evolution is because you're assuming that there can't be a creator God. And that all that stuff accounts for that. But, see, I can turn it all around and say, why is there that pendactyl pattern? I kind of mentioned this last time. I want to be more clear on this. Why is there the pendactyl pattern? Why is there this 5 over the place? Because God put it there. Why do we have to say there's got to be some reasonable explanation? Why can't it just be this was the way God wanted to do it? Can't God do anything he wants? And that's why we have to make really clear, is this the best of all possible worlds? And Hunter says, who says? Now that's kind of a reach. And the assumption is, well, a perfect God to make a perfect world. Who says? Do perfect artists make perfect works of art every time? Can't you choose to make something quick and easy? I mean, and we're making a lot of assumptions here, and that's part of Hunter's argument. That's part of what I want you to realize. And so what troubles me is when I see people saying, well, we have just got to come to terms with what science has given us. Well, what has science given us? Science has given us, look, there's correlation between the DNA. Okay. What science has given us is, look, we can see patterns that seem to relate between the species. Okay. Is that proof of evolution? No. Any more than it's proof of a creator. I mean, evolution can be used to explain that, but so can a creator who likes patterns be used to explain it. It's not clear-cut proof. And so then we start talking about, well, we've just got to come to terms with this clear proof. It's not that way. Now, I think that is eminently true in the world of biology. The more problematic it comes from the area of astronomy, or, you know, the bigger kind of physics sort of stuff. But even that is problematic only if you're locked into a 6,000-year-old Earth and this kind of stuff. And even that, you know, I'm not saying even that's a big deal because, as I've asserted before, could God create things already in action, you know, a created universe that has memory in a sense? Yeah, that can happen too. So, you know, none of this stuff is the kind of slam dunk, well, we've just got to come to terms with this, and the only solution is we've got to start making some room. Why? You see, it's not that clear-cut yet, and that's what I'm saying. We need to give this some more time. In my opinion, I think we're kind of right about in the middle of this whole debate that started about 100 years ago, and it's got a ways to go yet before it gets all worked out. And there are many scientists who are not happy with the whole evolutionary account because there are so many big problems with it. And the idea that this is a foregone conclusion, we're selling the farm way too soon. I just wanted to make that real clear before we move on, okay? All right, anything else then from last time around? All right. Now, today, new stuff. We've got a few pages in Pieper, which we're going to crank through right away. Then we get to Bonhoeffer, and I'm looking forward to that. All right, so let's do Pieper first and get him done. And now we have an entire complete doctrinal section, and you can tell that because Pieper dedicates blank pages to the section break, and so you know this is a big deal. Well, look at page 465, or no, 460, where are we here? Get my pages right. No, I got to go back. It's 490-something. 495 and 6 are nothing but blank paper. Okay, so this is a big deal. And what is the big deal topic we're into? Angels. And if we're going to talk about angels, what else are we going to talk about? Yeah, demons, of course. So, angels and demons, what a great topic for October 31st. Perfect. Who wrote the syllabus? Wow. All right. What's that? There was a design indicating a intelligent mind behind it all. Yes. All right. So, angels and demons. You see a read through paper. Let's hit some highlights. I don't want to get too bogged down in little stuff because I have a suspicion you're going to have some bigger questions you're going to want to talk about as we get our way through this. And then I do want to make sure we have time for Bonhoeffer, so let's just get cranking on this thing. All right. So, he's going to get into this whole discussion about angels. And Pieper spends a little bit of time actually defending even having this as a locus. Okay. Now, you remember that terminology, right? Did you learn that language in Confessions, locus? Locus is nothing more than the Latin word for place. And so when we do theology, systematic theology, we take all these teachings and we try to pull them together in one place. And then we call that a locus. And so we call these a locus about like angels. So angelology is the locus for all of our discussion about angels and demons and the supernatural metaphysical world around us. When we're doing salvation discussion, that would be the locus called soteriology. When we talk about the church, that's the locus called ecclesiology. You get the idea? And this is why, what was Melanchthon's famous theological textbook called? The Loci Communes, okay? And the Loci Communes, because Loci is just plural for locus, and common, the common places where we gather all these things. So now does that make sense? Okay, that's what the Loci means. And if you're church Latin, you'll call it the Loci, and if you're classically trained Latin, you call it the Loci, because the hard C is classical and the soft C is church Latin, so that's the difference there. So either one goes, but you can tell who was trained by what, how they say it. All right, so the Loci Communes, I had a classical education. So the Loci Communes, the common places, we have a locus. So we're going to have a locus called angels. And that's what we're going to get into here, this whole discussion about angels and demons. And Pieper's saying, yes, we should talk about this, and yes, it has a place because this is part of the creation. That's his point he's trying to make. All right, and he has a nice footnote here on the very first page, 497, from this infidel, David Friedrich Strauss, which is actually a very kind name for Strauss. Strauss was one of these morons in the 19th century who was just completely eliminating any possibility of miracles and then went through the Gospels trying to decide what was legit. And so he makes the point, Strauss does, if you're going to blow off demons interacting with Jesus and just talk about an idea of the evil, then why are you having a concrete Christ? Why not just have the idea of the good? Which is quite apropos, and so actually coming from the mouth of an infidel, kind of interesting. All right, so truth is truth wherever you find it. That's the point. Okay, so when were angels created? First point. Sometime during the 6 days of creation. And there's a term that he uses here, which you should know, because it's a term that shows up in other places, hexameron, which means what? This is on 499. 6 days. Yeah, the 6 days. So the hexameron is just the fancy Latin term, it sounds pretty cool, for the 6 days creation. So if you really want to blow people away, say, well, you know, when it comes to creation, I really believe in the hexameron. And people go, well, I knew we were going to get a liberal from St. Louis. I knew it. And so, they'll be persuaded. And so then you say, well, hexameron means the 6 days of creation. Oh, you're okay then. So now the point is, why do we know this? Do we have a scripture that says, and then God made the angels? No, we don't. So we're doing this on a surmise, which is a little bit risky, but it seems pretty solid, because could they have been created before day one? Could they? Yeah. What was there before God created? Nothing. Well, God. Yeah, thank you. All right. So God is there. And so then God creates. Now, the question would be, can maybe angels perhaps exist outside of our created universe and they're part of a different sign of creation? Perhaps. And if you're going to go that route, we can open it up to the possibility that they were there before the day one of our creation. But Genesis starts with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and there was nothing. The tohu vavohu, and then there comes things. And so that would indicate kind of the grand nothingness into the creation. But we can always offer the possibility, I suppose, that maybe, there is another universe here and here, and the creation story is just giving us our universe's creation account, perhaps. But we don't need to really go there, and that's not that big a deal.
Nate. I was just going to ask, I think it's Augustine who says, when he says created the heavens and then the earth, that the heavens refers to spiritual beings, and the earth is what was tohu vohu. and then we have our nice little place.
Perhaps. But I would tend to think heavens usually just means the stuff up, and then the earth means the stuff down. And in the Hebrew cosmology, it's not really a spiritual material divide. So I think that would be a wrong move. Okay? Now, so, and then the other reason we would say sometime in the hexameron is because on day seven, what does God do? He rests from his creating, which doesn't mean he's laying back in his lazy boy, but what it means is he's not actively creating new species or new things anymore. So sometime in that time period, angels were created. That's how we come to that conclusion. All right, name angel, what does it mean? Yeah, nothing more than messenger. Comes from the Greek, angelos, which just means a guy who brings a message, a messenger. So that's all it means, and that's why you can actually have, you know, John the Baptist being called an angelos, a messenger, and prophets were angelos or angeloi, so they were messengers. So that's not a big deal here. So that's fine. That's just simply what angelos means, is a messenger, one who brings a message. All right, now we get into more interesting things. Nature and property of the angels. One of the key things we need to remember about angels and then demons, because remember, by definition, what is a demon? Nothing more than a fallen angel. There is no difference between an angel or a demon when it comes to their ontological properties or their abilities or their capabilities or anything like that. They are the same kind of beings cut from the same sort of material that God used, and they're the same in that way. All right, so these are just fallen angels. That's all. Now, both creatures then of God are immaterial, meaning they are spirits. They don't have any kind of concrete material form. Now, what that means starts to kind of rattle our minds again, because we think of spirits as being immaterial, so that means they can just kind of like be everywhere. But no, they can't, because they're not God. Joel?
Based on Scripture, we can't say that it's an absolute statement, right? Because there's times where, like, an angel
appears. Now, that's what we need to talk about. They are immaterial spirits, and so that means they have no body. But there are times when angels are manifest in the Bible, and they show up. So what can we conclude about that? Well, we can guess a couple of things, because we don't know definitively. We could say that perhaps the angel is merely taking on some sort of outward form to accommodate the human being, and so it's more like a projection of a holographic image, you know, kind of vaporous, you know, and the sort of thing. Or maybe for a while they take on a human body and they appear in a human body. And maybe it's a human body that God's got, you know, like in a closet up there, and he gets it out when he needs it, and here, Gabriel, here you go. And I go, hey, I'll take the body and I'll kind of hold it up and, you know, stand there behind it. And, you know, it gets a little weird thinking when you think about it, but that's kind of the idea. In other words, they're taking a form that they don't have naturally, they're taking it for our benefit, and it's simply a matter of accommodation. So that Mary can hear from Gabriel, Gabriel takes on some form that is recognizable, and that's what's going on here. So that's the point. So they have human bodies only for our benefit, all right? This is critical then, because one of the big move that we're trying to make here is angels and humans are completely different things. They're two different categories of creature. Completely different. And this is so significant because it has become common in our culture to assume that when people die, they become angels. And what's that? It bugs you. Good. I'm glad it does, Dan. You get this all the time at funerals. You know, oh, he's my guardian angel now. Or God took this little one, so now he's my guardian angel. Now he's watching over me. And someone asked me the other section, where did this come from? And it's kind of interesting because you can actually trace this back a little bit. And it really hit its stride in the late 19th century into the early 20th. And it was really propagated by the media. Things like It's a Wonderful Life, you know, the great Christmas, oh, what a great movie. Well, those are the kinds of things that actually fueled this. There is nothing really in church history that's ever come up with this, but it really got fueled by just the popular imagination to the point now where it's just taken over and people assume this, you know. And you even get people in the church all the time talking about get my wings when I get to heaven, or I'll become an angel, I'll watch over you, or grandma's up there watching over me as my guardian angel. That's all junk. It's garbage. Humans don't become angels, ever, never. And so it's just not that way, you know. It's a Wonderful Life notwithstanding, sorry, it's just not that way. And so we need to recognize that there's a huge marked difference here in our just the whole understanding of our ontology. Humans are material beings with an animated soul in us, and that's what makes us human. Angels have this animated soul, but no body. So who's cooler? We are. And angels know it, which kind of gets to later on, and I'm kind of serious about that, because angels exist for our benefit, not the other way around. They serve God, and God's purpose is to take care of his creation, so the angels are involved in caring for the creation. That's what they do. They are on our side and here for our benefit. So that's an important point that we have. Now, also we know, though, that these are immaterial spirits, but they are creatures. And as creatures, they are limited. They are not omnipresent. They are not omniscient. They are not omnipotent. And even Satan, then, is in the same category as the rest of these creatures. So he is not omnipotent. He is not omniscient. He is not omnipresent. He's not everywhere at once. Now, where this gets a little hard, then, is we would say that they are defined, then, by a localized presence. They can be in one place. But they don't take up any space. So where exactly are they? How big are they? You know, they're like really, really small on your keyboard, or are they really, really big and filling the whole seminary campus? Don't know. But the point is, they're not like God, who is everywhere present at all times. They have to be present at one place, at one time. That's it, because they're spirits. Now, their relation to time, don't know. Their relation to, you know, kind of spatial sorts of things, I don't know that either. You know, can they quickly move between places? I suppose. And maybe they can move between times. I don't know. But what we do know is that they're not God, that they are creatures. Ryan.
Yeah, I was just kind of having trouble balancing between the idea of being material, and if you're not material, being being bound by any boundary of space.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to reconcile how you can have a localized constriction.
Right. I know, that's part of what it's agreed. That's a tough thing to kind of figure out and get your mind around. But my main point, I guess, is I'm not trying to define what that presence is like. What I'm trying to say is they're not God, and they don't have the ability to be in all places at all times all at once. That's not in their thing. So in other words, if Satan is busy working one place, he's nowhere else. Now, plenty of his, you know, fellow demons could be present, but he's not. And my point of that is because they're not omnipresent. They're not God. Again, we're talking about two different dimensions, two different kinds of reality, and what does that really mean? I don't know. I'll try not.
It's more like their will and intellect is limited in an operation as opposed to their spatial locality.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm not going to say I know for sure definitively what their spatial locality is or isn't. I know that they're not omnipresent, though, the way God is. Gerard.
So, I mean, Peter mentioned it just one sentence, I think, about the whole Sons of God thing.
Mm-hmm. Footnote.
That thing.
So you read it.
How is that possible with the materialness? I just don't understand.
Well, basically, the bottom line for that is that reference in the Old Testament to the sons of the angels being involved or the sons of the God was probably more of an adjectival description of these beings rather than that they were actually ontologically angels. So in other words, it's sort of like calling Barnabas a son of encouragement. I mean, he was an encouraging guy. And you talk about some guy being sons of the angels, just meant they were, you know, really tough, big dudes or angelic kinds of guys. But they're still humans. Because if they're having relationships, they're human. They're not angels. And that's the bottom line. Yeah, he mentioned in passing. You're right. But that's the bottom line. It's just an issue of exegesis that, you know, don't get hung up on this. The terminology is referring to people, not to angels, which is the simplest solution, because then you don't have to get into, well, maybe angels can hang out with people, and it gets all weird then. So just let them be people. All right, Joe.
I was just going to say, if you thought Peepers, back to the locality of angels, if you thought Peepers mentioned that it's similar to a human soul, in terms of we know where it is,
mm-hmm.
It's not like it's actual taking up any space.
Yeah.
Is that helpful?
I think so. I mean, that's kind of why what I'm trying to get with Ryan. You know, there's this commonality there. And the way that we have souls, which are discrete, individual, localized souls, while angels and demons have being, which is discrete and localized for them, whatever that means in that realm, in the realm of dimension, which we don't know much about. But we're more aware of this than we are of other things. And we have a sense of this reality, which is why we have that sense of our the immortal soul, the idea that we aren't meant to die, and we get a sense of these things, and we get a sense of something more than just us. And so we're aware of that realm more than we maybe admit, and we need to be aware of that, but we don't know that much about it. Okay, now, if angels and demons aren't omniscient, that would mean then that Satan can't read your mind. And it would also make us rethink this idea of Satan or demons implanting thoughts into your head. See, I'm not convinced they can do that, which doesn't mean you're off the hook because your own sinful nature is going to be bad enough trouble anyway. But so the thing is, Satan can't read minds. He can't predict the future, but he is certainly sharp, knows human nature really well, and knows trigger points, and he can have things happen that will suggest different thoughts to your mind or have, you know, different triggers, and he's good at that kind of a thing. But I think we need to be a little bit careful not to overextend his reach or his ability beyond what we actually know. And this is also one of the reasons why I think it's wise that when you're praying, you know, for God's intervention, when you're being tempted, that even praying out loud whenever you can is a really good idea. You know, invoke the name of Christ and tell Satan to take a hike. And you pray out loud, and you don't just, you know, in your thoughts, and Satan can probably guess what you're doing, but even to invoke the name of Christ, there's something to this. And it's not just magic or superstition. There's something to that, and I wouldn't diminish that.
Well, you know, and the idea that you talked about him being the great deceiver is one of his names. Well, he's deceiving. It doesn't mean he's doing it to you.
Right.
But his deceptive ways are causing you to lead
right.
in a direction you may not want to go.
That's right. All right. Good? All right, now, so this is very well said, top of 502, about the 12 lines down. Men lack an all-embracing understanding of the realm of spirits, and particularly of the might and ability of the spirits. Exactly. And that's what I'm trying to say. I'll admit my ignorance on these things, and we don't know a lot, but we do know a few things, and we have to be careful to keep some of these things in check so we don't get carried away with saying things beyond what we should say. All right, so 503, they're not omnipresent. Sons of God discussions on 503 as well, and we've covered that already. 504, number and ranks of the angels. Are there lots of them? Yes. How many? Don't know. How are they ordered? Don't know. Don't even go there. The scholastics really got into this stuff. We don't need to. All right. Then we have the idea of the fallen angels. Yes?
I have a question on that. Is it safe to say that there's no new ones being made?
Yes.
And would that go for demons too?
Yes. Yes.
So Satan's army is numbered and finite.
Yeah, it's finite. Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Which is, I think, a safe assumption. Again, we don't have definitive things about this, but that seems like a pretty safe conclusion to reach. All right, now we go. Yes, Gerard.
Okay, I messed up about something. You were talking, this is from earlier with the soul thing, how angels have that too.
Well, they are that.
They are that, yeah. And then we have that. Is ours also not definable? We don't know how big it is.
Yeah,
how small it is.
It's a soul. What
I'm
is it?
Bigger than him, just because I'm bigger than him.
Sure. Stephanie's just little, you know. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. I think the bigger point is that... No, it's good. Gerard, it's a legit question. I think the bigger point is to recognize that when we talk about a human soul, and we'll talk about this a little more as we move along here, just the whole idea of our anthropology, that... we often would say that man is body and soul together, and that's what makes a man a man. And that, yes and no, even the idea of this kind of body-soul division is probably too neat of a bifurcation. We simply are human. And as human, that means we are material and animated with the breath of God. And so the breath of God, the Ruach of God, what is that? It's God's animating force. So does it take up any material space? No. And is it identical with who we are? Yeah, but the material is also added to this, and so that's what we are. And so that's where you get the kind of the horror of death is this tearing apart of what God meant to be together, the soul being pulled away. So when the soul is disembodied, that's a bad thing. It's a really bad thing. And how much space does that soul take up? I don't know. Does that soul look like you but kind of translucent? I don't know.
But I definitely know, we know that it's here, though. It's not.
Oh, you mean your soul right now? It's you. You are your soul. You are your soul, but you are your body too. And so that when you die and your body becomes lifeless and inanimate at that moment, you know, well, that body is still you, but your soul is still you, so now you're a divided self. And this has got, like I said, kind of big eschatological funeral kind of implications, because now we see this as a bad thing. Whoa, I'm disembodied. See, angels are cool, but it's being disembodied. They're that way. They're complete when they're disembodied. When we're disembodied, we're incomplete. We're kind of messed up. And you get this even in Revelation where you have the souls under the altar saying, how long, God? You know, hey, they should be in having the party. They're disembodied. Well, no, they're looking forward to the resurrection. And it's a little bit like getting caught, you know, oh, I'm not quite dressed. You know, I'm not quite myself today. I don't have my body. You know, I'm a little embarrassed. I need to get that back. I'm just a soul right now. It's a little bit weird. And that's exactly the way it is, because you're just kind of out of sorts. Something's not quite right here. And that's the point of the resurrection, is souls and bodies back fully human again, like I'm supposed to be. So that's a huge difference. So, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because I wanted to stress that a little bit more, this whole, by definition, humans are this soul-body thing together. And like angels and having this soul, but not like angels and having a body, and what that soul even is real, and it's very much there. And we actually see it in action, because we see what happens when a body is dead. We get it. And people see him and say, oh, it doesn't look like him. Well, it does, but it doesn't. Something's missing. Huh, yeah, the soul's not there. Something's missing. It's kind of weird. That's why you always kind of creeped out by dead bodies. Not quite right here. Which is right. In fact, when people get too comfortable around it, then something, they're getting kind of weird. We all know that. All right. Okay. All right. Good. Moving on. 505. Now, we encounter here one of the teachings of the church, and this is not just an LCMS weird Lutheran thing. This is actually part of the teaching of the analogy of faith, but it's one of the teachings that is perhaps thinly attested scripturally and not given a lot of thought, which is the idea that angels, either good or evil, are confirmed in their position. They're confirmed in this. And so we say that they're confirmed either in righteousness or they are confirmed in their evil, or in their wickedness. They're confirmed in this. So a fallen angel is fallen, done. And a good angel is good, done. This also extends to what we teach about the resurrected body. Because we teach that at the resurrection, at the eschaton, we will no longer be capable of sin, but we will be confirmed in righteousness like the angels. You know, this is all part of what we teach. The question that's interesting is, you know, Pieper gets into this, he talks about this, and then on page 506, he makes the point too. It says, the good angels are confirmed in the good and are in the state of bliss. Their bliss continues consistent in the beatific vision of God. But what's noticeably absent here is any scripture reference. And it's interesting. Now, am I saying this is a wrong teaching? No, I believe this is absolutely true. And I think it's really important to stress this idea of being confirmed in righteousness. And we get some hints about how this would play out, because what we have people saying next is, the vision of God is most intimately united with the love of God. Whoever beholds God cannot but love him as the highest good. And so the will of the good angels coincides constantly and perfectly with the will of God. The sole object of their entire activity is accomplishment of the good. So in other words, the will of the confirmed angels coincides with God so perfectly that they're not able to do anything but that perfect will, which is what I believe is the description of the saints in eternity at the eschaton as well. And that's the way to kind of pursue this. But quite frankly, if you were ever looking for something to pursue as an STM kind of a topic or even further, this would be an interesting thing to look into, the whole idea of the eschatological confirmation and righteousness sort of a thing. I think it would be worth looking at. Now, this also raises questions about if they're confirmed in their evil, where did the evil come from? And we're back to that problem that Plaker points out. Good question. Don't know. It just comes because of their willful disobedience. And the debate then is, what was the original sin? Nobody knows for sure, but pride seems to be a pretty good candidate. The idea of wanting to be like God or wanting to be other than creature. So the idea of simply sort of kind of asserting self, which is really what pride means, to assert self, is typically the base sin. And as we're going to see, as the creation story unfolds, this could be really seen as the base sin for Eve and then Adam as well, this pride. Even though Luther would argue that Adam's sin was that he loved Eve too much and just followed her into sin because he cared. What a great guy. I like Luther. Francis, you know, poor Eve. She was just deceived, and she did a dumb thing. And Adam says, I can't let her go alone. All right, Eve, give me the fruit. I'll eat it too. Let's go. Or maybe not. Anyway, Francis.
Yeah, I'm looking at page 506. Around the second paragraph, I believe, where it talks about the elect angels.
Yep.
What is your take on that? Because I guess it's people in terms of there's not enough detail pertaining to elect angels.
So what about, what's your question?
What's your own take on that?
What's my take on that?
Yes.
Well, if we're going to have a doctrine of election that God knows those who will be saved and he chooses them, I think that can extend to angels, no problem. So these are the elect angels and the rest weren't, and that's just the way that is. Leave it alone, because now you're into the whole, well, wait a minute, why? No, don't ask why. God elects. Yep. Tim.
So we're saying that angels sin.
Yes.
And it's not that our original sin, which corrupted creation, affected them.
Correct. In fact, if you read the Genesis 3 story as the serpent being Satan, you know, playing the games, then their fall precedes. All right. Yes, Joel.
So it kind of gives Satan this kind of thing of, okay, I fell, so God, I'm going to spite you and make your other creation.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's kind of getting into this whole next discussion about their activity. So what are they doing? What do the demons do? Demons basically are really busy trying to undo God's good creation. And that's the best way to think about demonic activity, I believe, is anything that kind of thwarts God's good creation. And here, I'll call upon one more time C.S. Lewis. He just thinks about these things really well, I think. There are some things he's not so sharp on, but this stuff, he's just got nailed. And in The Great Divorce, how many of you have read that? Okay, just a handful. Put it on your list. Got to read The Great Divorce. Good stuff. In The Great Divorce, he plays with this idea of evil and its role in our lives. And then in Paralandra, how many of you have read that one? Even fewer. Ah, Space Trilogy. Got to read that too. Don't read it for the science fiction effect. Read it for the theology. The theology is outstanding. The science fiction is pretty shoddy, but the theology is really good. See, Lewis was a mediocre writer. Tolkien, outstanding. But anyway, they're all, and the reason I bring them together is so they're all part of the Inklings, along with Charles Williams. Throw him into the bunch, you get these guys, and they're all, you know, infiltrating each other's work and encouraging each other. It's a pretty cool bunch. Anyway, Lewis in Paralandra has this scene, and the setting of Paralandra is Venus, and this is an unfallen planet, which is fascinating to think about. Because, you know, we assume that the whole creation means all the whole universe fell, but Lewis said, oh, maybe just this planet fell, and we can have other parts of the universe still in sync. Gerard.
Oh, sorry, no. I was just raising my hand so I wouldn't forget what I said, but I want you to finish what you were saying.
Oh, well, you can go ahead. I don't want you to forget. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I'll remember where I am.
This has nothing to do with anything that you're saying.
Oh, that's fine. That's the best.
So, Hexameron, right? If they were created during the Hexameron,
yeah,
which is what we're thinking,
uh-huh,
then the war in heaven was at the same time.
Yeah.
And then, so in Isaiah it says that, you know, Satan was hurled down to the earth, you know, whatever. Why would God hurl him down to the earth?
See, this is great questions, and these are kinds of things that I think are worth thinking about a little bit, but not overthinking. The point is that we're talking about the spiritual realm here, and so Satan's been hurled down to the earth, and that means he can't go to heaven anymore? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. It just basically means that Satan has been set loose into this creation and kind of, you know, sent forth. And that's a huge question. Why didn't God just finish him off right then? That'd be a lot better. But
I'm a theater major, so I think theatrically, why would he hurl him down into something and then the next sentence say, that's good? You know, like...
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, so maybe the fall happened on day 5 at 6 o'clock in the evening, you know, towards the end of the day, or maybe even first thing in the morning on day 6. I don't know. And I don't know if we need to press too hard in asking these sorts of questions. What we need to know is the account we're given is giving us the basic bones of what we need to understand, that this is a good creation that has been thwarted and messed up by a fallen creature and by a fallen demonic activity, which is also involved in trying to bring this creation down. And that's really the point. All right, now back. Go ahead, Mike.
Just to follow up on what he was saying, that you get Ezekiel 28 and you get Isaiah 14.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see Pieper using those at all in here, and I thought that was fascinating that he doesn't quote those.
Yeah.
Is that because we're just not willing to go that far scripturally?
I think we're
going to say that's a human ruler, and it may have overtones.
I think that's the point. We want to be really careful not to overstretch what's going on here. And so then you have Christ talking about, I saw Satan fall, you know, from as lightning from heaven. And you, well, when did that happen? It happened when the 70 went out? Maybe. Or maybe this is a proleptic kind of a thing, and the falling is with the crucifixion, the resurrection. Or maybe it's back. You know, it's hard to say. Because, again, we're talking about different realms here. The point is that Satan's rule is limited and curtailed and constrained by the reality and the length and the reach of God. It only has so far it can go. All right. merit.
Oh, no, that's fine.
I never thought about the fall of the angels being within creation. Is there
right.
a Bible, is there a, do we have anything that we suggest that's like the fall happened immediately? Like
no.
Day seven, okay. So it's not like.
It's a simply conjecture based on what we know. You got the creation happens here. By day six, you got the serpent tempting Eve. Somewhere in there.
We know that it's day six that the temptation.
Well, okay, good point. We know that somewhere after the day seven, day of rest, Eve has fallen and we have the fall. So you're fair enough. So I guess you're right. Fair enough. You're right. The fall could have happened on day eight or something like that. Now, Luther was of the opinion that the fall actually happened on day eight. He thought it happened the very next day. But we don't know. So you're right. There could have been a few thousand years where Adam and Eve were just hanging out and doing things just great. So you're right. We've got more time. I was misleading all of you. There's more time. All right. So we can have a long war in heaven if we want. Yeah. Yeah. No problem. All right. Thank you, Merritt, for clearing things up. Yes, Kevin.
My question revolves around that. So when the angels fell and there's the evil, but we say that God didn't create evil.
Correct.
He allows for it to happen.
Yes.
Now we, as humans, we're sinful because Adam and Eve were tempted by the evil. But at what point?
What's the origin?
What?
Where does it come from? Why did Satan do it?
Yeah. Because it's like, were the angels tempted to have this pride? Because God wouldn't have created the evil prideful.
Correct.
He would have allowed for it, but he wouldn't have created it.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. Exactly right. Good. All right. That's fine. No, if you're looking for me to clear it up, I'm not going to clear it up. You're exactly right. Joel.
Was the fact that we could be tempted that made them evil? Because I always kind of thought that temptation, because Jesus was tempted.
Right. We'll talk about that more next quarter, actually. But see, temptation itself is not wrong. What's wrong is what you do with it and how you handle it. That's the problem. And so whether Satan was tempted, I don't know. We don't know much about it. It doesn't really do much good to speculate about it. What we're told is that he disobeyed God and was, the idea of the war in heaven was kicked out. All right. Now, back to Perelandra. Meanwhile, back on Venus, one of the scenes that Lewis has in here is really phenomenal because he has an Adam and Eve figure living here, and they have not yet fallen. They're being tempted because a Satan figure has shown up and is having conversations and talking and trying to persuade them to be disobedient, which is the whole premise of Perelandra. And then there's a figure from the world who shows up there and who is looking to intervene, which is the fun of Perelandra, and you just got to read it. It's the end of it. Just wow, man! And don't forget Genesis 3:15 while you're doing the end. Okay, just a little hint. All right, but there's one scene in here where the tempter is got a little downtime. Eve is sleeping or something, and so the tempter is just kind of bored, and the protagonist sees this lizard lying on the ground dying. And can't figure out what's going on. This is a perfect world, and there's a dying creature here. And he looks and realizes that the back of the lizard has been ripped open. And he sees another one, and he kind of follows him. And then he sees the Satan figure wandering around the island, just picking up these innocent lizards and ripping them open and just dropping them. Just doing it. And why? Because he's Satan. Because this is God's good creation, and he just screws it up, ruins it, just for the hell of it, literally. And it's such a powerful little image, and just saying, and Lewis just kind of tosses it in there. But I think it's really insightful about how Satan operates. Satan doesn't operate with rhyme or reason. He doesn't have to have any grand big plan. He just wants to mess up God's creation at any possible turn. Anything he can do, he'll do it, just to mess things up. Whether that's causing chaos in a war, or people dying from a disease, or a marriage getting torn apart by strife, or children rebelling, he'll just do it, for the fun of it. That's what he thrives on. And this is the important thing to kind of think about when you're thinking about understanding Satan and his method of operation and what he does. His goal is simply to undo God's good creation at every turn. And is it fair to say, well, that's satanic activity? Yeah, that's fair to say. Now, does that mean we know what Satan's up to? No. But we're seeing God's good creation being broken or destroyed or twisted or perverted. That's satanic activity. That's fair to say. All right? Yes, Stephanie.
So since Satan can't read our thoughts, he also can't put thoughts into our
That's head. Correct. I would agree with that.
So, like, how does he make something material become a temptation for us, like, in the immaterial, like, in our thoughts? Like,
yeah, I think some of that just comes from, like I said, he knows humanity really, really well. He's been dealing with us for a long time. And so probably he's the greatest psychologist who ever lived, you know, or ever existed, because he knows things really well. So he knows what kind of experiences would help us to formulate certain thoughts, and he knows what kind of triggers are going to remind us of things and allows these things to happen. So while he can't put thoughts in your mind, can he allow something to happen, like, you know, swerve the wheel so the guy cuts you off on the interstate? Sure, knowing that's going to just set you off. Sure, that can happen. And so those kinds of things can happen. And while I don't think you can maybe plant thoughts in your mind, maybe you can literally whisper ideas that just kind of, where did that come from? I just had this thought. You know, so maybe you're hearing things without even realizing it. Now, that can possibly happen. I'm not ready to say, you know, I understand it all, but I am saying that he's limited, but he knows us really well.
Okay, so even though he's not omnipotent, he is more powerful than we are in the sense?
Yeah, in many ways. He's probably smarter, more street smart kind of thing. Yeah, he knows stuff. Yep.
So thinking about Christ's temptation then, when Satan tempts him, do you think personally that he actually took Jesus to those places, or did he work in the spiritual?
Either way, I don't know if I have I don't really have a dog in that fight. I'm not that worked up about which way it goes. I tend to think it was he took him there, and they, you know, there he was, and you know, the literal thing. That's how I would read it. So that seems to fit the text better, but. It could happen. It could all be happening in a spiritual sense and still be just as real. More of that next quarter. All right. So back to what's going on. So what are the angels busy doing? If Satan and the demons are busy trying to undo the creation, the angels are interested in upholding the creation and serving it and helping it, and they do that. And then Pieper has this nice little discussion in here about, do we have guardian angels? And what's the conclusion? Maybe. Yeah. Which is kind of a nice thought. Because we would be tempted to say, no, well, maybe. Why not? It's possible. There are plenty of them around, and they're certainly invested in us. And maybe you don't have your own personal guardian angel, but do you have angels present watching over things? Yes. And I alluded to this last time. I'm talking about how, you know, God cares for us in his providence and sees us through things. I believe in this stuff. Absolutely. Things that are just coincidence. Is that possible that an angel intervenes and just pulls in the bumper a little bit to slow you down a little bit as you're heading to the intersection? Yeah. I believe that. I believe that can happen. I don't doubt that. And on the contrary, can a demon be present there, just kind of kicking things along, making sure they happen lousy, or making sure that that woman appears to just that right time to cause the temptation? Yeah. I mean, that can happen too. So when bad things are happening, is this, you know, satanic activity? It might be. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. But we shouldn't limit this. A lot of you guys are familiar with the Peretti books, this present darkness kind of stuff. And, you know, it's pure speculation. But I would tend to think that his view of a very active, busy metaphysical world, which impinges on ours, is probably closer to the truth than one of, oh, there's nothing going on out there. No, it's a very real world, okay? And they have an impact on our world, and they are involved, and we should recognize this. And so angels are there to help us and take care of us, and they do that kind of stuff.
I agree with you about the Peretti books. My only concern was it was just an overarching sense of dualism through the books, where it was like
that's very true.
Own it's almost like power. That's yeah. When there's a war, who's going to win?
Yeah. No, I agree with that.
That was a little too far. But
that's a little bit much. And also the idea that somehow we empower them by praying. I think that's a little problematic. But anyway, Chris.
When we're talking about this, what immediately came to my mind was the instance in Daniel where the angel appears and said, "I was kept from coming to you because this." Fight or whatever was happening here. So there's something I think too that and the warring of forces.
Yeah, but what all that means and exploring it too much, just kind of leave it alone. That's where I'm coming from. So don't discount it. Now, this also goes to what about you hear about demonic activity sometimes or haunted houses. I take this stuff seriously. Now, do I believe that the soul of the worker who was building the lighthouse is still haunting the lighthouse because he died in building it? No. But do I believe that demonic activity might be present there because it's fun to deceive people and to goof things up? Yeah. And so when you hear about stuff happening, which is inexplicable, it's probably inexplicable. It could very much happen. And you know, you've all heard stories about Ouija boards working. I believe they do. I do. You know, the idea that the thing was pulled right over. Yeah, and it's not just your power of suggestion. Demons are real. And that's why you don't monkey around with this stuff. We take it seriously. You hear this, and I'll play this out just a little bit further. You've probably heard this out before, but I think it's accurate. Satan works in the way that's going to be most effective in every any culture where he is. In our culture here, our very sophisticated Western culture, he's doing really well by kind of playing low key and acting like he doesn't exist. And everybody kind of poo-poos him, but he's very much present and active. It's just that you don't recognize it. And that works well for him. And in a culture where people believe in demons behind every other leaf and are, you know, looking for them all the time, he can be very effective in showing little shots of power every once in a while. And so when you hear stories about, you know, like in these developing countries where you hear about crazy things happening, and missionaries come back and tell stories about demon possession and activity, I don't discount that. I don't say, well, yeah, you know, no, this is the real thing. This is how things work, and it fits his MO. So the Rolling Stones were right, you know, sympathy for the devil. He's there doing stuff, and he's behind things. When the Blitzkrieg raged and bodies stank, yes, this is him, Dan.
So would you say most people that say they've seen a ghost or believe in ghosts actually have experienced a demon?
They very well could have. Now, they might have just had a hallucination. They could just be kind of freaked out because they're strange people, or they might have actually seen a real demon. It's possible. You don't. It's hard to know for sure, but I wouldn't discount the possibility. And when people talk about, you know, a place that seems to be particularly creepy, yeah, that can be really very possible, because there are places that are, you know, places matter to God, and certain places are good and some are not so good, and that's there's some truth to that.
But you would say it's not a person that's been removed from their
body. No. Can't be. Can't be. It's not grandpa coming back to greet me, or it's not some wicked old lady who got murdered and now she's trying to harass everybody else. No. And again, all the movies pick up on that stuff, but no. This would be some demonic manifestation. It seems like even a seance. Is that real? Yeah, there's probably a lot of reality going on in a seance. But is it, you know, really somebody showing up, or is it just the trick of that person showing up and a demon pretending to be that person? That's what I think it is. Go.
Is it also sound for us to teach that, like, witchcraft and voodoo is a direct result of demonic?
Yes, very much, yes. And we need to teach our kids to leave this stuff alone and our people not to mess with this stuff. You know, not that it's going to get you, but it's just, why do you mess with this stuff? And there's more reality there than less. All right, yeah,
Kevin. In talking with all those movies that show this demon stuff, I believe it's real, but I always thought that my reassurance was, you know, if you believe in Christ and you trust in him, fine.
Yeah.
But when I read deeper, yeah. I was shocked. He said bodily possession presents, or it says also children of God may suffer this.
Yeah, he did say
possession.
That, didn't he? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's on page 509. We're almost there. Okay. We'll go there now.
Sorry. All right.
John first.
I was just going to go back. What do you think about the witch in Samuel then?
The witch in Samuel, I thought someone might ask about that. That's kind of murky. My take is that the text is not definitive either way. You know, if it was Samuel who came back, that was because God granted a special dispensation and Samuel's cranky about it. You know, what are you making me come here for? So maybe that's it. Or there's nothing definitively that says it had to be Samuel. Could it have been a demonic trick and Saul was deceived by a demon pretending to be Samuel? That's possible too. I don't think that proves anything either way. I'm always reluctant to take a narrative and make that definitive for doctrine. You have to be careful. And this happens with this, on a whole different plane with the book of Acts a lot. There are a lot of things in there that are descriptive without being prescriptive. Another classic example. Well, David had a whole bunch of wives. Well, and then we should too. Or Abraham had more than one wife, so should we. No. And monogamy is God's will. And just because the Bible doesn't say explicitly they were dumb when they did this, we can realize they were dumb when they did this. We know that without having to figure it out. So you don't use narratives to prove doctrine. All right, now moving on. Bodily possession. Kevin's troubled by this, as he probably should be. I think what Pieper's getting at is this. We need to make a distinction between what we might call spiritual possession and bodily possession. And what Pieper is saying is he's making this distinction. And he's saying, is it possible for Satan to take over a person's spirit? No. Because if you're in Christ, you're in Christ. That can't be compromised. Satan can't come in and force his way in and take over. But bodily possession, can Satan do that? He can. That's what people are saying. Now, that troubles us. You think, oh, man, I don't want to be possessed by Satan. He might just get me or something. But I think we have to be a little bit more careful here and broaden this out just a little bit. And I want to talk a little bit about this whole dynamic interface between the spiritual, the mental, emotional, and the physical. And it's far more complicated than we think it is. And it's far more intricate than we think it is. We tend to divide these things out nicely and neat. Okay, we got bodily things, you take a pill for that. We got mental things, you talk to a counselor for that. We got spiritual things, you go to a pastor for that. And then you go and you visit a parishioner who's having some trouble on a psych ward and they've been admitted. And you walk on across that psych ward and you listen and you watch and you spend a little while there and you leave and you think, I don't know where the lines are anymore. Because it's not clear at all where the lines are between what's spiritual, what's mental, emotional, and what's physical. They interact all over the place. And this gets back to the whole point of this kind of neat division between we're spiritual and material, but we're us. And we are spiritual material all the way through and all mixed up and it all runs together. And you can't really divide them out as easily as we want to think we can. So does your physical health affect your mental health? Of course it does. And does that affect your spiritual health? Of course it can. And all the others vice versa. And it all ties together. So when Pieper talks about being bodily possessed, we got to put this kind of in the context of, so when someone gets cancer, is this a really lousy thing that has happened to them? And is their body being taken over by some kind of evil? Yes, right. They are. Now, are they still within God's purposes and God's control and God's care? Well, sure. But this is a terrible thing that's happened to them. And I think when we talk about satanic possession, it's kind of on the same level. So he can take over a body and he can cause pain and suffering. And he can inflict things on you, but he can't touch your relationship with God. So what I would say is what really way to understand this is rather than going spiritual bodily, let's go rather two kinds of righteousness talk and think about this way and make a distinction between Coram Deo and Coram Mundo. Satan can't touch Coram Deo realities, but he can mess around with Coram Mundo stuff all over the place. And he can cause all kinds of strife and problems in the Coram Mundo, but he can't interfere with your Coram Deo reality. Where you are in Christ is where you are in Christ. Now, you can choose to compromise that. That's another topic for systems theory. But in the Coram Mundo, he does all kinds of stuff. And so do people get sick and suffer and experience horrible problems in their bodies? Sure. And do people get mentally ill sometimes? Yeah. And how much of that is physical? How much of that is spiritual? Boy, I don't know. It's not so easy here. Not so clear cut. So is it possible for a Christian believer who is a solid believer to experience some kind of really strong, you know, suffering mentally, which starts to even maybe look like spiritual? You might even say, I think they're possessed. Yeah. And you guys have encountered this. Now, what we have to be careful of is this doesn't diminish the responsibility. So we go to like an alcoholic, classic example. Is that a physical disease? Some would say yes. Is it a issue of self-control and choice, and it's a purely a mental responsibility thing? Some would say yes. Is it a spiritual thing? A lot of people would say absolutely it is. Well, it's kind of, I would argue, all three are at work here. And you are always responsible, and you recognize the physical realities, but you're still responsible. And see, I think the same kind of thing needs to start to spread out to some of these other issues. So do we need to be worried about exorcist kind of stuff, you know, this thing coming in and taking over me and my head spinning around and spitting up green stuff? No, we don't need to worry about those kinds of things as much as you need to realize that Satan is very active and he does have this kind of ability to mess up our lives here in the Coram Mundo realm. And how this all fits together, we have to be a little bit more long-suffering and a little judicious and not be quite so definitive in saying that's purely a physical problem, he just needs to be treated with meds, or this is purely a medical problem, or this is a spiritual problem. It's not so simple. And the further you guys go along in your ministry and you start talking to people who are struggling with things and you're trying to do some counsel with them, you're going to see what I mean about how the interface of this stuff plays out. It's not so easily divided.
But it just seems like I hear what you're saying, but it seems like there's a pretty drastic divide between alcoholism and gerasene demoniac or exorcist.
Maybe, but maybe not. See, even the gerasene demoniac, some people might say he's just going through some kind of mental illness, or is it like epilepsy sort of a thing? And that's what's going on. And so when he calls out in other verses, he's just got some kind of a psychotic episode. I mean, if we had a gerasene demoniac running around campus today, what do you think we would do with that? We would haul him off and have him, he would have him committed and he would be going through psychological tests. We would not consider him to be a demoniac, even though he displays all that. And that's my point. And if you go to a psych ward, it's remarkable how the spiritual stuff is just thick there, and the conversations and what people say, it's just palpable, and the presence of the stuff. So that's what I'm saying. I don't think it's so easily divided. I don't think it is. I'm disagreeing with you. I think the lines are not so clear. I think they tend to bleed into each other pretty quickly. And good grief, how do people always just talk about alcoholism? The demon alcohol got me. And a lot of alcoholics will still talk that way. They talk about it like it's a demon possession. It just gets a hold of me and gets me. You start dealing with these people and these things, and it's not so clear cut. Joel?
Going back to that, the casting out of the demon for that guy, one thing I noticed, though, is, I mean, he asked to follow Jesus afterwards.
Yeah.
And Jesus sends him out, go and tell everybody what I've done, all that God's done for you.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, and you have all, you know, Jesus comes, and it's like, he immediately is waging war against these demons. In all the accounts where he's healing, he's casting out demons.
Yes.
I almost wonder if he's using them to bring people to him.
Well, it's with the demons, you know. Well, in a sense, there's some, maybe that I can live with that, I guess. Perhaps. I mean, God used things for his purpose, whatever. It doesn't mitigate it. It doesn't, you know, make it good. But sure, I can live with that, I guess, if I know what you mean.
I'm looking at this, and it just seems like it made it, I don't know.
Okay. Nathan.
So I'm done with the whole thing you said about Satan not being omnipotent or omnipresent.
Hmm.
But I don't know how that leads us then to say that he can't influence our thoughts, especially once we've admitted this intertwining and intermeshing physical, psychological.
Yeah.
It seems like we just, if you're going to say that, then you have to admit that our consciousness can be.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's something going on here. What I really want to make clear is that Satan is not like God. He's not omniscient. He doesn't know all these things. But the interface, and I'll agree with you. Your point is well taken. I agree with you that there's more going on here between this interface. And I'm not sure what it all means. And I'm not ready to say, well, that wasn't demonic, or that was. I'm tending to say, yeah, Satan's involved in all this nasty stuff. So I agree. I hear you. Well said. Jeff.
The pastor at my fieldwork church is doing his doctorate on stuff like this.
Mm.
And he shared with me the information about...
You're down at peace then?
Yep.
Yeah.
He shared with me the stuff that happened here on campus with the boy from the Exorcist.
49. Mm-hmm.
And when you take a look at all the physical things that happened to him, I'm seeing this all come together in one actual example.
Right, exactly.
You know, the physical writing that appears and all that type
right.
of stuff.
Right. Okay, anybody else? And he's talking about the fact that The Exorcist, the movie, was based on an actual incident that happened to a little boy in 1949 who was actually LCMS and came here first. Then they sent him to the Jesuits. Gerard.
Okay, so my confirmation class understanding tells me that angels are just kind of soul things or whatever, and then we're both, and then animals are just bodies.
Okay.
With an essence, maybe, who knows? Really cares. But anyway, so when Jesus casts out the demons into the pigs, I was told that it was easier for the pigs to take on that soul.
Oh, because they didn't have a soul in the way?
They didn't have a soul in the way. It's easier to attach to them, whereas for us,
I think that's overreaching.
It's overreaching.
Okay. Stephanie.
So what happens, I guess at the asking to angels and demons, because God will be judge over them as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
it says they're consigned to the pit. So they're judged and condemned and suffer eternally.
But angels?
Oh, angels, no, that would be the demons. Angels are just going to be doing what they're supposed to do all the time, playing their part in God's creation, whatever that is, whatever he wants them to do.
So they will,
messengers.
They will exist.
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah, they're part of the creation. Yeah, I believe that. Yeah. All right. Good. Good. All done. Anything else? Angels and demons. Enough for me. All right. Now we close the door on Pieper, and we open the cover on Bonhoeffer. All right, you only had to read less than 20 pages. Aren't you glad?
Yes. We had to read them three times.
Did you really? All right, I warned you, okay? I warned you. The first part of this is the toughest sledding. It gets a little better as you go, but this is heavy stuff. So what'd you think? Just real quick, a couple thoughts. Daunting. It's not the easiest read, is it? It's deceptive because it's big font, big margins. you know, short pages. He's like, oh, this would be a breeze. Whoa, you read a paragraph, what did he just say? And it's one of those kinds of books. And because Bonhoeffer is being very uncharacteristically German here. Pieper is your classic German writer. He has a thought, and he takes three paragraphs to make sure you get it right. And you're going to make sure it's all covered, it's clear, clear as day, boom, there you have it. Bonhoeffer does the opposite. He'll take a sentence, and every single word is carefully chosen and just filled with meaning and just overflowing with significance. And you've got to almost let every single word kind of fill out to get what he's after here. So he's not easy that way, all right? Any other quick thoughts, or anybody? All right. Now, what do you know about Bonhoeffer? How many of you have read the Cost of Discipleship? Okay, a couple of you. Good stuff. Life Together? All right, that's required reading in a lot of classes around here, so you're kind of familiar with that. So you read those two things, and you think, oh, I can handle Bonhoeffer. Then you read this, and you realize, wow, this guy is something else. And his credentials are incredible. He wrote this in 31. This is early in his career. And this was originally done as a series of lectures at University of Berlin. And then later, because of the acclaim they received, he put them into writing and they got published. So he did this. But there's a remarkable continuity to Bonhoeffer, in my opinion, because in his Ethics, which he wrote when he was imprisoned, there's the similar themes are going on here. And everything that I see going on in the Ethics is already here. And I see a lot of continuity. Now, Bonhoeffer is kind of a lightning rod individual. People love him or they don't like him. And there are some people who insist that he wasn't even a Christian. He denied the resurrection, which if you read this, impossible to believe. Because he's talking about the resurrection all over the place in here. And he does the same thing in the Ethics. So I don't know where that came from. I disagree with it. Later in his life, Bonhoeffer wrote some things. They were kind of collected in a thing called Letters and Papers from Prison, where he started taking some very radical stances against talking about like a religionless Christianity and Christianity after God, these kinds of things. But what he's really after, in my opinion there, is being kind of consistent in the same way Kierkegaard was, of attacking the institution of the church as it was and trying to point to something more significant than that was there. And I think you need to read Bonhoeffer in light of things like Creation and Fall and Cost of Discipleship and Life Together and his Ethics, and then I believe those things make sense and not the other way around. Stanley Hauerwas agrees with me on this, and actually he has the opinion that people who dismiss Bonhoeffer or think he's a liberal have read him from the back forward and get him wrong. And I think that's right. And so I'll just be up front and tell you right off the bat, I'm a fan of Bonhoeffer. I like him a lot. The more I read of him, the more I think he was just profoundly insightful and right on track with stuff. I mean, his take on things is just mind-bogglingly cool, I think, on so many things. Now, having said that, now I've got to try to justify some of the stuff you're reading today. And it's like, whoa, what's he up to? What's going on here? So let's take some time with what we have left here, and let's actually just kind of crank through this thing and try to pick apart what he's doing, and I'll try to shed some light so it makes it easier for you as you go forward. Because for the next few class periods, this is all we're doing, which I am so happy about. All right. Now, he says the very first thing. First sentence, the Church of Christ bears witness to the end of all things. It lives from the end, it thinks from the end, it acts from the end, it proclaims its message from the end. All right, what's he mean by that? What's he mean by the end? Eschatologically. He's talking about the eschatological fulfillment. Now, what is the eschatological fulfillment? It's when Christ comes in glory and everything is consummated and everything is Christ. And what does St. Paul say? And Christ is all in all. So in other words, the end is Christ. That's Bonhoeffer. Christ is, it's all about Christ. Everything is about Christ. And so when the church lives from the end, it lives knowing what it's all about. Now, this is big for Bonhoeffer, and it gets even bigger. Because the end means we know the telos. That's what end means. In other words, we know what it's all about. Why does the church exist? To bring people to the telos, to bring people to Christ. We talk that way all the time. We don't even get the fullness of all it means. And if that means we live from the end, that means we take that knowledge and that certainty and we bring it back into the present, and now we see the present in light of the end, which changes things. Okay? So that's what he's getting at. All right. Now we skip down to the next paragraph, about six lines in. And for something you ask, want to ask about, do it. Otherwise, I'm just cranking along here. The old world. Okay, what's he mean by old world? The fallen world, the one we're living in, the world in opposition to God. So old world is key or code for the world in opposition to God. fallen world. The old world cannot take pleasure in the church because the church speaks of its end as though it had already happened, as though the world had already been judged. Yeah, we do that all the time because we know, foregone conclusion. And the world doesn't like that. The old world does not like being regarded as dead. Funny. Yeah, it doesn't. The church has never been surprised at this, nor is it surprised by the fact that again and again men come to it who think the thoughts of the old world, and who is there entirely free from them? So we're all invaded by this. The old man is around. Okay, safe. So far, we're all good here. Now, last six lines on the page. It knows, the church knows, that the beginning and now, knows that the beginning and now are related as life is to death, as the new is to the old. Therefore, the church only sees the beginning in the end, from the end. It sees the creation sub specie Christi, in other words, under the reality of Christ. Better still, in the fallen old world, it believes in the new creation world of the beginning and of the end because it believes in Christ and in nothing else. All right, now, what Bonhoeffer's doing is saying, we think about everything from the end, but now he's going to be talking about Genesis 1 to 3, which is the beginning. And he's saying we only know the beginning in light of what we know of the whole story, so we only know the beginning in Christ as well. And he's going to do this all the way through this book. Even though this is Genesis 1 to 3, Christ is going to pop in all over the place. When you least expect it, all of a sudden he's talking about Jesus. It's going to happen again and again. It's like Bonhoeffer just can't get away from Christ for more than two or three pages at a time. And then bam, he comes right back in. Because it's all about Christ. All right, now we go to the next page. About eight lines down. I'll pick up a little sooner than that. What does Holy Scripture, upon which the Church of Christ is grounded, have to say of the creation and the beginning, except that only from Christ can we know what the beginning is? That's huge. The Bible is nothing but the book upon which the church stands. This is its essential nature, or it is nothing. Therefore, the Scriptures need to be read and proclaimed wholly from the viewpoint of the end. Thus, the creation story should be read in church in the first place only from Christ, and not until then as leading to Christ. We can read towards Christ only if we know that Christ is the beginning, the new, and the end of the world, and the Bible then is the book of the church. All right. So what he's saying then is we only know the beginning in Christ. And we can only know about it as we look through Christ. So this is the whole thing. We see the beginning and we can only know of it because God has given us, shed some light on this. That's his premise getting started. Now we get into chapter 1. So he's going to do this whole thing. It's just going to be verse by verse. And you've already kind of picked up on this. But while this is a theological lecture at an academic level, it's remarkably devotional. Just in the way he approaches things. And you're going to find that often. There can be passages here that are just so devotionally beautiful. All right. Now, eight lines in. Or a little less. That the Bible should speak of the beginning provokes the world and irritates us. For we cannot speak of the beginning. Where the beginning begins, our thinking stops. It comes to an end. And yet the fact that we ask about the beginning is the innermost impulse of our thinking. In the last resort, it is this that gives validity to every true question we ask. What's that mean? What did he just say?
We want to know why.
People want to know why. So it's the little kid, 6 years old. Daddy, where did I come from? Why am I here? And he's not asking about the sexual question. He wants to know the purpose of it all. And if you're not a believer, what do you say? Well, you know, you were just fish once. And now, how many millions of years ago? And now, look, you're a person. Isn't that cool? Yeah, that's satisfying. But you see, there's this insatiable desire to know where do we come from? What's this all about? What's going on? What's this all mean? And so we want to know, but we can't. So he says, thinking stops when we start thinking about the beginning because we simply can't know it. We can't reproduce it. We can't study it in any kind of scientific way because we can't make it happen again. And we can't get back there to watch it happen. We don't know. We are fated to ignorance about it. We simply can't know. And we don't like that. And the reason we don't like it is because it makes us face our limits and our finitude. And man hates being limited. Because if he is limited in not knowing, that means he is a contingent being and he is not autonomous and self-sufficient, which is the myth of modernity and the myth that man has always tried to propagate ever since the fall. I can stand on my own, thank you very much. I don't need anything else. And I certainly don't need God telling me where I came from. I'll figure it out, thanks. That's natural religion. That's man on his own. That's modernity. And that's why we hate the beginning. Hate it. Okay? Now, go to page 12. Bottom part of the page, just below halfway. Because thinking desires to penetrate to the beginning and cannot do so, all thinking crumbles into dust. It runs aground upon itself. It breaks to pieces. It is dissolved in the presence of the beginning, which thinking posits and cannot posit. In other words, I can think of the idea of beginning, but thinking about what it means, I'm baffled, lost. The Hegelian question of how to gain a beginning of philosophy is therefore answered only by arbitrarily enthroning reason in the place of God. And that's how Hegel starts, with reason. And he says it's just an arbitrary move. You got to put something there, so you take God out and put reason in. And then he goes on. Critical philosophy is therefore systematic despair of its own beginning and of every beginning. Whether critical philosophy proudly renounces that which is not in its power to obtain, or whether its resignation leads to its complete destruction, it is always the same human hatred of the beginning, of which we have no knowledge. Hatred of the beginning. Man no longer lives in the beginning. He has lost the beginning. Now he finds he is in the middle. It's a critical technical term for Bonhoeffer. He's going to use it again and again. We're in the middle. And he's actually going to use the term differently as he moves along. But for now, what does the middle mean? The middle means present existence. We don't know the beginning. We don't know the end. Can't know. Oh, they're out of our realm. What we know is the present, the middle. And so we're stuck living in the middle, and we don't like that. And we resent the limitation because it's a limitation on our very being as humans, and we hate it. So we hate the beginning, but we demand to know about it. And think how true this is in real everyday life. How many millions of dollars do we spend sending space probes out to try to learn about the beginnings of our universe? Why are we so fascinated with this? It's because we want to know about the beginning. And we're hell-bent on proving we can figure it out, whatever it takes. And you think about the kind of vociferous kind of attitude you get from guys like Dawkins, you know, just mock belief in God, and we know all the answers, evolution takes care of it all. Doesn't that fit exactly Bonhoeffer's profile? We hate the beginning, we rise up in pride against it, and we deride it, because we will not be constrained as humans. Won't. Gerard.
You say we, are you including Christians?
I'm including fallen man. Okay? So you can throw Christians if you want to, but I'm just thinking about fallen man. All right, now let's go on this then. Knowing neither the end nor the beginning, and yet knowing that he is in the middle, coming from the beginning, going towards the end. He sees that his life is determined by these two facets, of which he knows only that he does not know them. He's stuck. He's just in a jam. The animals do not know about the beginning and the end, therefore they know no hatred and no pride. They just exist. Man, aware of being totally deprived of his self-determination because he comes from the beginning and is moving towards the end without knowing what this means, hates the beginning, and rises up against it in pride. Bingo. Doesn't that just resonate with just everything? And now you begin to see what I was trying to get at last time. I said, I just don't get that fired up anymore about all the creation questions. This stuff gets me so much more fired up because this is so much more profitable to what we're dealing with in reality, with the way people think, the way they act, the way they hate the church, the way they rise up against things. This explains stuff. It's just so insightful. All right. Now, he says, same page 13, no one, the very bottom of the page, into the paragraph, no one can speak of the beginning but the one who was in the beginning. So, what do we rely on to know about the beginning? God, his revelation. This is exactly right. All right. Now he gets into the next couple pages. He's discussing some of the philosophical roots of this. You got Feuerbach and Freud being talked about without by name. You got Marx coming into play here even. This is exactly what's happening. And then you got this kind of the beautiful kind of work that he does all the way through here. He quotes Luther about Luther, what was God doing before he created cutting canes? People ask dumb questions. All right, this is all good. Now he starts talking though in here about this idea of the void, and this is another important term, because he's meaning by this two different things. What he's saying is the void, from a Christian standpoint, is nothingness, and we all know that what can nothingness create? Nothing. All right, but the problem is that the man in the middle has made the void into something. And what he has made the void into is something that actually does things like creates big bangs. And so out of the void comes the creation. So if the creation is coming out of the void, then the void must kind of almost be something. And that's what Bonhoeffer's doing here when he starts talking about the void. He's playing off two understandings here of how we look at the void.
I was coming under the impression that he was thinking of the void as like this, like, expanse of freedom between God and the creation.
That's the negative idea of it, that it can do something. This is the top of 17. This is where he kind of really gets at this. About four lines down. The nothingness of the man in the middle who does not know of the beginning is the last attempt at explanation. It is the point of passage for what is. We call it the void, which is brought to consummation, filled to the full and sovereign. See, that's the point. It's sovereign. It does something. And so what he's saying is, when man is baffled by the beginning and he says, well, there was just the void and then everything happened. What he has just done is he has just made the void something. He's filled the void with pregnant power. It can create a big bang. It can explode the world into being. So the void's doing something. And then the very next line, he contrasts that with the truth, with the reality. And he says, the void between God's freedom and the creation is not an attempt to explain what is. It is thus not the matter out of which the world has then paradoxically come into being, the necessary point where what it comes through, nor is it a thing, not even a negative thing. It is the definition which alone can express the relation of God's freedom to his creation. The void is therefore not a primal possibility, a ground for God himself. It is absolutely nothing. That's the point. So the void is just this nothingness. There's God, there's the creation, and in between, the void. And the void is not something. It can't do anything. Nathan.
So I understood him to be saying essentially the same thing that Plager was saying, that the void is basically this distinction between the finite and the infinite, which ruptures all language that tries to cross.
I think that's exactly right.
And because it's what he's going to use to say that causality is not the right way to talk about God creating.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly his point. Yes, right. Bottom of that same paragraph, same page. The world stands in the void. This means that it stands in the beginning. And that means nothing except that it is rooted in the freedom of God. See, the absolute freedom of God does what he wants, when he wants, as he wants to. The creature belongs to the creator. That's the real drive. And the point in all this is the absolute contingency of man. He is dependent on his creator. He is contingent all the way through. All right, now to the top of 18. And so now we get to this whole, like I said, resurrection. Yeah, this is huge in here. Starting on the bottom of 17. Indeed, it is because we know the resurrection that we know of God's creation in the beginning. So I told you, you can't get very far without Jesus coming in. Of God's creation out of nothing. Now look at the parallel he draws between creation ex nihilo. You know that term, right? Maybe you don't. You should know this one. Ex nihilo means what?
Out of nothing.
So we believe in a creation ex nihilo. Now look at the parallel that Bonhoeffer's going to do here between creation ex nihilo at the beginning and the resurrection. The dead Jesus Christ of Good Friday and the resurrected Kyrios, Lord of Easter Sunday. What a contrast. That is creation out of nothing. Creation from the beginning. So it's a new beginning. And see, now the parallels are outstanding. Because when did Christ raise? On the eighth day, the new first day of the new creation. Pretty cool stuff after the Sabbath is over. The fact that Christ was dead did not mean the possibility of the resurrection, but its impossibility. It was the void itself. It was nihil negativum, the nothing, negative. There is absolutely no transition or continuity between the dead and the resurrected Christ except the freedom of God, which in the beginning created his work out of nothing. God brings Christ back to life. God brings creation into existence out of nothing. Just does it. That's the point. All right, end paragraph on this section. This is a good, nice summary section before the three diamonds. In the beginning, out of freedom, out of nothing, God created the heavens and the earth. That is the comfort with which the Bible addresses us who are in the middle, who are anxious before the false void, the one that can do something, the beginning without a beginning, and the end without an end. It is the gospel. It is the resurrected Christ of whom one is speaking here. What? How did he get here? And so the point is, you can't do anything apart from the resurrected Christ. Everything makes sense in him. Without him, nothing makes sense. God is in the beginning, and he will be in the end. He is free regarding the world. The fact that he lets us know this is mercy, grace, forgiveness, and comfort. Exactly. He speaks. He reveals himself. All right. Now, over the top of 19 then, second line, the earth was without form and void. Nevertheless, it was our earth, which has proceeded from God's hand and now lies ready for him, submissive to him in holy worship. This is beautiful. God is worshipped first by the earth, which was without form and void. He does not need us men to prepare his glory. He creates worship himself from the silent world, which slumbers, resting mute and formless in his will. this is profoundly beautiful. So when you have this new creation that is still formless and just there, is it worshiping God? Yes. Why? Because it's a creature, a creation, doing what it was created to do, just being. And its very existence brings glory to God. That's so cool. And so this sheds light on even the idea of the animals praising God. Does it mean they stop and say, praise God? No, they're just being good animals. And the rocks and the hills praise God. Does that mean the hills are going to clap their hands and start praising God? And, oh, God, you're so cool. No, they just are good hills. And they praise God by being what they were created to be. Profoundly beautiful. This is really cool. All right, good. So then we got the spirit hovering over the dark, over the deep, and we're cool with that. And we have the unformed versus the formed, and that brings us to the end of the very first chapter.